Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, boys and girls. This is Wayne Klingman with the first premiere episode of Radio Free Mafia. And today, for our first episode, I can't think of any better guest that I can have than the co-writer of my book, Anne Frank. And we're going to talk something that he really likes to talk about, and I do as well. I can only call them the sick serial killers of nightmare, because they, when I read about them and research them, they scare the hell out of me, because, in my opinion, there's more out there than we might know about. There are way more out there than we know about. And you never know when the guy that you stopped to help in the side of the road might be one. So with no further ado, let's say hello to Zach Long. Yay, go you, Long. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. And that, I'm excited to give you some nightmares tonight.
That book, it was one. I knew they were out there, right? I did, right? But not to that degree. And I know you're not going to know them all, but the crazy vampire killer out of Spain was scary.
I am a fan of, interestingly, actually, in that there's more than one vampire killer, and each of them are actually quite interesting.
Oh, please do tell.
Well, you got, like, the vampire of Dusseldorf, for example, which I'm pronouncing wrong, but, oh, God. I didn't prep up on this ahead of time, but I can tell you there's easily 5 to 10 different serial killers who have all been titled with vampire, because it's just such a well-known word. It implies evil. It implies bloodlust, a feeding on the humans around you in order to satiate your own needs. And so it's a very potent word for use with serial killers.
Right. It just bring me, if I'm reading the newspaper, say, if I'm online looking at whatever, and I can click on a link that goes, read about the vampire killer of Miami, I'm going to click there, because to me, that word vampire means they've done something horrific more than once, and I want to know what they did. And then when you find out, you say, oh, my God.
Absolutely.
I mean, to me, I know we're not going to know about them all, but I would thought, and I'm so bad with pronunciation of names, but the woman in Spain, I mean, she was a monster.
I would argue opposite. I would argue that she was portrayed as a monster. I think that she is actually the fall guy for a much grander, I would say even more evil sort of plot, which sees the upper classes feeding on the lower classes and then sticking the blame onto a lower class, mentally unstable person, because that's going to be easy to get away with.
So you think, in other words, if I may be so bold, maybe I misunderstand what you're saying, that it was a conspiracy to frame her?
Yeah, so the person that we're talking about she's known as the Vampire of Barcelona. She's also been called the Vampire of, I'm going to pronounce this wrong because it's in Spanish, but the Vampire of Carrer Ponet and the Vampire of Raval. And her name was Enriqueta Martí, which, again, probably pronounced wrong. But she lived from 1868 until 1913, and she is thought to have been just the absolute most evil woman, and that she was thought to be a child serial killer, a kidnapper. They thought that she would prostitute the children she kidnapped, and then they thought that she would kill them. She would then cut up their bodies. She would boil their fat, take their hair, use it for all sorts of different potions and elixirs that she would then sell to the upper classes, and that they would buy them because potions were supposed to, you know, give you a hard on that never went away, give you beauty beyond your years. However, if you look at the evidence, the only solid evidence that we have to link her to crimes, the only part of it which is provable without a shadow of a doubt is that she once kidnapped a girl, a singular girl. She was responsible for that one kidnapping. And if you look at that kidnapping, she kidnaps this girl. She brings her back to her flat where she has another child. Now, this child, I believe it's a boy. I may be mistaken on that. That child, she claimed, was related to her. Many reports said that he was, that the child wasn't related to her. But then later reports confirmed, oh, no, yeah, that child was related to her. I think it was her brothers or something that she was looking after. So a lot of the early reports that we have about all these horrible things that happened to her, the main source that they took was essentially gossip and a lot of cannibalization of the media at the time. This newspaper printed this fact, so the next newspaper reiterates that fact like a parrot repeating what you said.
And making it worse, it over the top, so get, okay. Wow, so maybe she was a victim of bad press.
I believe that she was absolutely a victim of bad press, but I think that the story as a whole, and that if we can look at it through two lenses, we can look at it through the bad press lens, in which case what we see is, like I mentioned earlier, we see an upper class feeding on the lower classes, and that in itself, that's a vampire story told a thousand times over. What's Dracula? Dracula is an aristocrat. Who's he feed on? The peasants. So it's a, we see that there. Or we can look at it as if she were herself a killer. So if we look at that story, what we hear is that, so she's young, she's from, I forget what town she's from, but she's not from a large area. She moves to Barcelona when she's fairly young and gets involved in prostitution.
Right, like she had a
Why
choice.
She's involved in, oh, sorry.
I like she had a choice. Go on.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, it was especially not that she had a choice, because it was a very, very bad time to be in Barcelona in general.
Yes.
And so she gets involved in prostitution, and apparently she learns enough from the madam that she works for in order to start her own high-class brothel. How does a lower-class woman start a high-class brothel? That's a very interesting sort of that's one of the holes in the idea of her being this big serial killer. But so she gets this high-class brothel going, and she's brushing shoulders with some of the biggest members of the bar in Barcelona. We're talking politicians, police, aristocrats, and that whoever is big and fancy, that's apparently who's coming to her. But because they're big and fancy, and that they also have their own tastes, and that's very peculiar tastes. And for that, she needs to go out and she needs to acquire
kids.
Children for, and then when after these high class people have used these children, she needs to then dispose of them. So because they did not find a ton of evidence of these disposals, well, then she must have been boiling them and doing them in these potions and stuff.
Right.
What they did find later on is that, she was making potions, but almost all the parts that they found were actually animal parts. So
right.
It's a blur. Yeah. That's a part where it blurs the line between what's really happening and what's not.
Right. And you see this. I'm sorry, go on.
No, after you, Wayne.
We see this even today with Epstein, you know. I mean, as in, we don't know what we don't know altogether, and right now he's being the bigger boogeyman than the gods ever put on this earth, which actually gives the people in charge the ability to pin things on him that he may not even be involved in, but now we have a dead scapegoat.
That's a very astute point, because so Epstein, he's dead, so we can pin things on him. But with Marty, she was alive, but she was not mentally sound.
Right.
And so and we'll see so many kind of lies get exposed. one of the ideas that happened is that she apparently there was a period of time in Barcelona around the early 1900s here where there was a lot of strife, and it broke out into a week essentially of riots, and that it was over workers' rights and technically it was over military rights, because a bunch of these military guys who had went through, they did their time, they were supposed to come home. Now they're the primary earners for their families. Suddenly they're getting called up to be drafted again, despite the fact they already did their time. This breaks out into a bunch of riots. During this period, apparently the police take Marty, bring her in. She's accused of this, but they let her go because of somebody, never says who, somebody powerful pulled strings to let her go. Then later, it's only when the kidnapping that we know for sure happens that she gets actually brought in and arrested. So a lot of the early stuff we hear is kind of just he said, she said. And yeah. The thing with Marty is she's never been – she really didn't have the ability to do everything that they kind of claim she did. She could not really take care of herself very well.
And again, she makes a convenient scapegoat.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting that she gets – that happened to her at a similar time when another brothel owner had been shut down for the same reason, that he was prostituting children. And so in the eyes of the public, there is somebody out there and that is prostituting children. And we know that there's that one, but apparently there was rumors that with the one that got shut down, there was a list of powerful people of which never got reported. That list never made it to the public or the press. And
yeah,
so everybody is distrustful of all of the power. And so you need to kind of pin something on someone and say, no, it's not just that. It's not just the upper classes doing this thing. This is a person who is kidnapping the children, killing them, and then cutting them up. It's something so violent, so abject, that the public stops worrying about the upper classes and starts feeling the emotion of that disgust.
Well,
and that
it's perfect. I mean, you have a time in Spain, revolution, right? After revolution, right? They need scapegoats because we're decent people. It's these other people, these evil people who are killing children that are making us do these things. I mean, it's perfect.
Oh, absolutely. And rumors about Marty would actually continue even after her death. For example, one thing that was reported was that she had been killed by by other prisoners in the prison. But she actually died because of I believe she had cancer of the ovary. And so one of the things that they reported from her house was all this bloodstained clothing, going like, oh, like why would she have bloodstained clothing in that, especially where it's down by the pubic region? She must be doing horrible things. She was dying and bleeding to death slowly over years. So you have this woman who is not sane. She's definitely not mentally well. She's had a hard life where it was just like being used after being used, and she had a husband and they would always get together and break up and get together and break up. And the reason they would break up is because she kept having to go out and prostitute herself, and he would then essentially just get real fucking pissed off about that. I'm sorry, but get really angry about that and then turn around and leave her. And so like her life was a constant cycle of having to survive and then basically getting absolutely abandoned because of the fact that she was surviving. And
right
by the end there, you get the impression that she was just wanted it to be over.
Can you blame her? I mean, I can if you're a young person, say you reach puberty, maybe you're doing this, maybe you're doing that. Now you got people, position of power, taking advantage of you, right? Raping you, you know, doing all kinds of things to you. You learn how to do it to other people because you quickly learn to use, if I may, compare my neighborhood where I live in Racine to her situation, is we have any number of kids who do not have a safe place to sleep at night, may not even be able to eat a meal a day, and we wonder why they turn to a life of crime, right? What choices did she have, really? I mean, yeah, we don't want her depressed.
I don't think she had any.
Yeah. I don't think she did. But now, in death, we made her a monster.
We made her a monster in life, and we carried that out.
Yeah,
we carried
true.
That idea forward for 100 years before people started to really try to look at the case from different angles and really sort of explore what was happening.
Yes, which is something I try to do with the book, Dark Minds, Bloody Hands, which is a book which you can find on Amazon, which I recommend everybody all buy today for $2.99. Is because I took the opportunity to help people try to understand what we read at first or what we might have heard at first may not actually be going what's on. And this is a great example that Zach talked about, where there's far more going on than we might believe.
I think that might actually be a very good summation of life in general, that whatever you look at, whether or not you're talking about a serial killer or you're talking about somebody that got angry at you on the bus earlier today, there's always more going on than what you see at first.
Yes. And do we take the opportunity, you know, to look into something? I mean, I had two people climb in my backyard and approach my home from the rear. The last time that happened, they proceeded to try to break into my home, right, a home invasion. Well, when I noticed them this morning, I got really, really hostile in a hurry. I was prepared to meet force with force. Then seconds later, I determined that they're in my property looking for the lost cat, right? You know, you don't know what's going on. You need to take that time to figure it out more. And
absolutely.
And it's kind of addressing away from serial killers of nightmare. I mean, when you read about her at first, it's hard to be, well, you can't be sympathetic because you just read about that supposedly she did all these horrific acts, right? It's only when you have the time to look into it a little bit closer do you realize there might be more to the story that's going on, right? Which I think is important that we learn about serial killers, especially the ones in Nightmare, because there might be more going on than we might realize. And we owe it to the victims as well as the supposed killers to find the truth. But let's talk about another more recent sick person. Let's talk about our friends in Canada. Would you like to start our conversation off on the couple of the year?
So I take it you're referring to our friends Paul Bernardo and his wife Carla Homolka.
Yes. Interesting couple.
That's one way to say it.
I mean, they're the ones, to paraphrase quickly, is for some reason they thought it would be fun to, can correct me if I'm wrong, they would think it was fun to find women, rape them, and then kill them. Do I have that in a nutshell correctly?
Yeah, so the way that it went down is very interesting, and when you look into this couple, and I run a website called scriptophobic.ca, and we actually wrote a little bit about Carla. But when you look into this couple, it's, I think, most revealing to start with Paul. When you look into Paul, you find out, like, okay, what are the trademarks of serial killers and sex criminals? Well, you got the childhood problems. When he was young, his father and that, I think he was, I want to say that he was 11 years old, Paul was, when his father was charged with child molestation. And this is the same father who would sexually abuse Bernardo's sister. And when faced with this level of abuse in the home, instead of standing up, Bernardo's mother actually she kind of withdrew and just started living in the basement instead, ignoring it all. Then later, when he was a little older, Paul finds out from his mother that that wasn't his father. He was born out of wedlock. And instead of having a moment of like, oh, good, that monster has nothing to do with me, it actually pushes Paul to be more hateful towards women. He really considers his mother to be a whore and a harlot, just an absolute, absolutely just like the worst thing. And so as he's growing up, he begins to, he has these feelings, and to bring it back actually to Dark Minds, your book there, it's similar to the way that, there was the one killer who you write about where he went to jail for a murder, comes out, and because the media basically said, hey, look at this guy, he wrote stuff, he's allowed out.
Yeah.
And we see with him the same sort of hatred towards women. But Paul did not begin with murder. Paul began as the Scarborough rapist. And he's likely raped upwards of 30 women. And that a quick look at it, you see that within 10 days, he rapes a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old. And that a couple months later, he tries to rape a woman. She fights back. A couple months later, he tries to rape a 15-year-old girl. Then a couple months later, he rapes a 15-year-old girl. A week later, he rapes a 17-year-old girl. It just keeps going like this over and over. And what he would do is he would find these women. Often he would find them by, you know, he gets on the bus and he sees a pretty lady get on. And so when she gets off, he gets off and he follows her home. Many of the rapes that he did actually happened in their yards, just the front yard of their parents' house, where if you're that woman, you feel safe there.
Yeah.
And so he was not only taking these people's body, but he was ruining the idea of safety for them. But
especially
at the same
home,
time, he's running he's not running a business, but he's doing well in his business and that, and him and his friends are taking pickup, like classes for picking up women and things like that. He's buying a bunch of the books on tape for how to be successful. So to the outside world, he looks fine. And one of the times when they're at the bar, he meets Carla. And Carla is not like any of the other women he meets. Even in his public life, Paul, he has a bit of a sadistic streak. His humor is very dark, very sadistic. And instead of being turned off by this, Carla encourages. So he starts courting her. I want to say it's in 87 or 88. 88 sounds right. But he starts courting her around this period while he's also continuing to commit all these rapes. So when they get together, Carla knows about this. So what does she do? She wants to help give him presents, an anniversary present, a wedding present, and that. And most people, you know, give me a flat screen TV and I'll call it a good present. And no. See, Paul had the hots for Carla's sister, and that would not only would he say horrible things to her, but he would break into her room. Which Carla would go into her room, break the windows so that Paul could come in. And as she slept, he would just, disgusting, he would stand over the bed and masturbate. And she's just letting him, like helping him do this to her sister. So finally, they decide that, well, it's time for you to have my sister. Here's a present for you. And Carla really wants to give this present to him because when Paul meets Carla, she's not a virgin, and that's always angered him. But her sister is. So I might be wrong on this next part because they do several things with different women. One thing that they would do is to drug the liquor that they would give them. But I think it was Carla's sister that they drugged pasta sauce and gave her spaghetti. And so, while also still giving her plenty of alcohol, because any of the women they ended up kidnapping, they always plied with alcohol. And they would videotape themselves sexually assaulting these women. You would see Carla would first assault them sexually, get them ready for Paul, and then Paul would do what he wanted. And so one of the first is her sister. And they actually mess up and they give her an overdose by accident. And so in the middle of raping her sister, she starts to die. And so they have to then she just straight up dies in front of them. And so they have to take her and that they got to put their clothes on her, bring her back up to the room, call the cops. Meanwhile, the parents are in the house, so now the parents are freaking out. And despite the fact that there's a lot of sort of oddities with their stories, the coroner and the police basically chalk it up to she suffocated on vomit during her sleep.
Wow. Wow. That in itself is horrific. I can think of many gifts my wife would give me. Her sister would not be one of them, right?
Yeah, I can't think of the idea of anybody saying, oh, you're my lover, then why don't you have sex with my sister? Even if you take out the drugging and abusing part, already that's not a healthy relationship that you're witnessing.
No, it's not, but yet I don't know what's more. I can have sympathy for the kid, for the guy. Because he's abused as a youth. I get that. I understand how that as a youth growing up, he would not know enough to get help, right? I get those things. I can see how his friends around him may not know he has these issues. I get that as well. His girlfriend, not knowing he has problems, is bothersome.
Well, it's not that she doesn't know. It's that she embraces them and supports
right.
them.
I'm sorry. Right, right.
That's
I mean, I apologize.
Even
yeah,
worse, I think.
Yeah, far worse. I mean, you think that, gee, you have all these fetishes. I think it's time for me, like, to run away fast, far.
Yet she actually helps him to kidnap women. And one of them, after they finished with her, they go to the store. They buy a bunch of concrete. They chop her into pieces. And then they throw the body parts into the lake, except for one that was too heavy, so it was just left on the beach.
Incredible. And how many people did they kill other than the sister?
Let's see here. How many would it have been? I want to say that they killed less than five. I think it's three or four.
I think three or
and
four
that,
two.
But there's probably close to 30 rapes there.
Yeah,
and there's a lot that we don't know because, like, in the early, around 2005, on that, Paul admitted to 10 more rapes after having been in jail for 10 years or so. And then there's also, like, there's been rapes of his. And even early on with those early rapes, it should be noted that what he would do is he would use a knife and threaten the victim and sometimes even stab them. So he hadn't killed anybody on his own quite yet. Eventually, they would end up being caught for a kidnapping because there would be witnesses to the kidnapping, and this leads them to get caught. And then first goes down, Carla goes down and basically says, hey, so he just beat me. I'm done with him. And that starts the whole collapse of this killer couple.
But she turns state's evidence, correct?
So she goes and she looks to get immunity. They say, hey, she was involved in these crimes. She's not getting immunity. But she does get leniency, which helps. But then after several months, so I mentioned one of the things that they would do was videotape these. And
right.
So the videotapes did not come out into the court for several months into the proceedings. So when those came out, prosecutors were basically like, oh, we made a big mistake. We should not have given her anything. Because she's just as sadistic in those as she was, as he was, essentially.
Now he dies in prison, right? Suicide, correct?
No, he is alive.
Oh, really? I thought he died.
He is alive, but Canada has a thing called the, it's also in the UK, I believe, in Wales, called the Dangerous Offender category. And so if you're a dangerous offender, you can actually just be kept in prison indefinitely. And so he's been up for parole twice, I want to say, and denied both times. And because of his dangerous offender status, he will probably never get out. She is out, though.
Right, she's out. She's married. She's a big to-do because she was caught going to a daycare with kids. She's married.
Yep. It's very interesting. Don't we see this often, though, with people, and that you have these dangerous criminals, they go to jail, and then suddenly everybody wants them?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm a pretty liberal person when it comes to giving people second chances and stuff. I am. But the second chance or, helping someone rape your sister, maybe raping her herself, isn't one of them. I don't get it. And kids, are you going to have a woman who's going to do horrific acts to her sister, another woman for that matter, have their children and you don't worry about them?
Yeah, it's very... apparently, as of 2020, she's now... living with her, without her husband or her children.
Thank God.
Something must have happened there, but
hopefully it was such a, hopefully the person found out what was going on. Maybe they didn't know. I can't hardly believe that, and got the hell out before it was too late. But yeah, it's incredible. I mean, this is and a couple that you would never assume by talking to them in normal conversation that they're that crazy.
Yeah, it's very that's one of the interesting parts, especially with the next one we'll look at, is the fact that you have these people who Carla was, oh God, how old would she have been in that? It went down in 93 and she was born 1970. So she would have been just in her 20s there, her early 20s. And so basically she's still a child. And It becomes a very interesting thought experiment to kind of imagine, okay, what did we do as children, and what would have happened, like, is that still how we consider ourselves? Because when I was just 20, I was a complete prick, but I've changed. Now, do we want to apply that same feeling to her? And I would need to look into her own history to see how her home life was and how she was raised, because she could very well have many of the same. But from what I recall, and that was that she scored much, much lower on the psychopathy list than he did. I believe the psychopathy checklist has 40 different points that you can check off. And he has more than 30, and I think that she only had 5 or 6. So it could be a very real possibility that she was we know that she left him because he was abusive. Maybe he was abusive far earlier. Maybe she would get stuck in this. It would take probably much more time and much more research than I've done for this podcast so far to really look into that, but there is the chance that she could possibly be, you mentioned how you had some sympathy for him for the way he was raised. She could very well have that same sympathy when we just haven't got into it yet.
There's a difference between, how do I put this? There's dividing lines, right? I can understand how Paul, right? I mean, I'm not making excuses at all for him, but I can understand how at an early age, because what happened to him growing up, how he may not, he might start to hate women. I understand that. Don't mean I have to like it. Don't mean I have to like him. No, I don't like those acts that he did, but I can understand it. And bring that into somewhat in consideration. But at some level, in my opinion, I'm no professional, that the act, thought of taking your blood relative, in this case her sister, and raping her, right, helping her husband assault her, kind of crosses all normal lines.
Oh, I'm not, don't get me wrong, I don't want to come across like I in any way endorse any of these actions.
Right.
And my thought is simply that it might be more complicated than
realize. I mean, how do you, as citizens in a free society, sometimes we're called to make these judgments. We get called to trial. We get tests and juries and the like. We debate criminal justice and when do we throw somebody away in a prison cell and throw away the key? When do we give them a second or third chance? And these are all questions that come up and questions that I don't think we do a good enough job debating. I mean, when the two guys tried to break my house, I discussed a little earlier, I think. That's why I kind of freaked out this morning, right? I knew for a fact after they got caught up, I knew who they were. I knew how they grew up. I know they didn't have a roof over their heads, anything else, right? They're horribly brought up. I get where they're now criminals. I understand that. Doesn't mean I want them bringing my home, right? But what do you do? I don't know what do we do. It's confusing to me.
That's kind of the thing where you enter any offender of any sort, whether it be a violent offender like we're talking now, or let's say somebody who just again and again seems to be getting caught for some theft.
Right.
And it becomes sort of, first off, okay, how much weight do we give to their history? How much weight do we give to their upbringing? But then also, okay, how much time have they been away, and how much do we believe that they changed? When it comes to certain issues on that, like let's say the criminal, he's in jail because he mugged somebody and he went in and he learned a whole bunch and he comes out and we see him as a productive member of society now.
Absolutely. But
when we get into violent crimes, we tend to have a much stronger emotional experience when we hear them, because we go, I could never do that, which at least I hope we say that to ourselves. But at the same time, what we do is we go, well, if somebody did something violent, then they must not be able to change. But if you look at, there was, I forget what her name was, she was known as, I believe it was called Child Rage. It was a documentary from about 92, 93, maybe 94, in that range. And they look at this little girl who, she was adopted by this family, and she's maybe, I want to say she's between 4 to 6. She's in that range. And she just had no empathy whatsoever. And this little child was like, she would literally like spend her days trying to hurt her little brother to the point that they had to lock her in her room at night because she would talk about wanting to put needles in him. And she would literally touch herself until she was bleeding and just, like they show footage of her talking with a doctor who basically is saying like, well, what about your parents then? And she's like, oh, I don't care about them. I'd stab them. And yet this girl who shows all the signs of being an absolute psychopath was able to be taught empathy and really turned around. And so if we look at that, our first thought is, okay, well, she's young. That's what it is. But it's a case where we see, okay, violence can be unlearned. You can actually change. So we get caught in this issue of, well, okay, this person did these horrible things. Can we forgive them? They seem to have changed, but we are always caught in that emotional sphere of, well, what they did was so bad, it doesn't matter if they change. And we then ourselves kind of take on a aspect of, we almost become monsters in our, and are just dogged persistence that somebody that once did bad will always do bad. So it becomes a very complicated thing that actually tells us a lot about how we as humans react to such grisly and graphic circumstances.
Right. Oh yeah, without a doubt. You're absolutely correct. It's all a situation about what's going on, why they did it, things like that. I know this. I'm willing to give people another chance depending on the crime. Some crimes I find so heinous, it's hard for me to do so, such as, say, child rape, child abuse, beating a child to death, which is a problem in the cigarette scene. You know, when someone beats me, this had a guy that beat their two-year-old to death, and it's hard for me to think of anything other than putting that guy in a cage forever. Because how do you beat a little child to death?
Yeah.
You know, but again, I don't know the situation. But yeah, and there will be, and it's probably more to that story than I know. And you're absolutely correct. We need to do a better job of making sure we know as the public and we know as members of the court system, the criminal justice system. But you also, wait a second. Okay. You also said that you had a surprise person for us to talk about. And who would your surprise person be?
I do. I want to touch on what you just said, which is you mentioned that, okay, we need to know more. And that's why you were describing that child being beaten. I felt inside of myself the same, that kernel of disgust within my gut on that. But at the same time, the way you ended that actually brings it back to what we were saying about Marty and the need to look deeper and to really examine it. And that my first reaction to that is an absolute disgust. But what is under that? Once I get past that, what else is there to that story? Where are the borders of what happened? Not just the heights. The heights are those heights and emotions. But where are the borders? Borders are the people. What brought these people to the situation? How did they get lost in this? And was their intention to beat a child to death? Was their intention something else? This happened, and it's this horrible thing where events spiraled out of control. And
yeah.
none of these were answered in that. And so this is what we talked about, the need to dig deeper.
Absolutely. We do need – right. Because even with that, I already knew – we have a horrible paper here. I already knew for the 3 or 4 paragraphs, the guy's name, the address – the name and the age of the child is all I knew, all the newspaper printed. We don't know what happened, right? And it's foolish of me because what 99% of the people do is that once they read the article, they get the guy's name, they'll go to the Wisconsin criminal court record system and they will search his name and find out his crimes that he did before, right? Because they'll be absolutely convinced that he's done a number of horrific things before he decided to beat the child to death, right? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe there's enough there that he shouldn't be still in jail, but he's not getting the opportunity to hurt the child. Again, we don't know what we don't know. And sadly enough, we like making snap judgments not knowing. But it's easy to make that snap judgment.
So let's continue this with another snap judgment that happened. Do you know of the murder of James Bulger?
Okay, James Bulger rings a bell, but I mean, it's not coming up.
He was the 2-year-old in the early 90s who was murdered in England by 2 10-year-old boys.
Okay.
And very, very famous story on that. So the mother takes the child and as she goes to the mall, she leaves him for only a couple seconds while she goes into a store or to kind of talk to her or something. It was only a couple seconds. But in that time, these two kids, and that, again, 10-year-old boys, they walk up to him, say, hey, want to come with us? And then they walk out of the mall. They walk down the street. They push him off of they push him off of an overpass, and he hits his head on the side of the road. And so now they're walking with a child who's crying and bleeding, and a couple people do stop and go, like, oh, hey, what's happening here? They went, oh, it's we're taking our little brother home because he hurt himself, and you know, they take him out to the woods, they torture him, they kill him, they leave him there. And It's absolutely a case of if your first reaction is pure disgust, as it should be,
yeah.
And then as you dig underneath it, you don't actually find a lot to sort of exonerate these kids within your emotional reaction. But one of the things that you see is you talked about how people, they look at the other crimes and they try to make snap judgments going, if this person did that, this must be why. And it's all this snap judgment of why this happened. And one of the interesting things about this case, which is why it connects to me so much as a filmmaker, is that one of the elements of it is that because it's such a heinous crime and the criminals are so young, their first thought is, okay, it has to be horror movies. And the news reported that they watched Child's Play 3, and that gave them the idea.
Oh.
And immediately everybody jumps on and goes, oh, of course, that's it. Violent movie, yeah, makes violent kids. Not taking into account the fact that, hey, actually, this isn't right. What happened was one of the two kids aren't related to each other. They're friends. One of their fathers rented this movie. I believe that he doesn't even have – I think he shared custody. I might be wrong there. The point was, yes, he rented this movie, but the kid never saw it. The kid never had access to it. But that did not stop the judge from pinpointing it as one of the reasons why this happened in court.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter who you are as a human. It doesn't matter what your level of authority is. We all still want to make these snap judgments, and we all really just want answers crystal clear of this is a bad person or this is why this person's bad. And the thing that we kind of ignore there is, A, it's always more complicated than it looks, and B, evil might just exist.
Yeah, without a doubt, evil exists. I mean, I'm willing to state absolutely without a doubt in my mind, evil exists. And I believe firmly that any one of us, given the right circumstances, can commit horrific acts that would make the things we talked about pale in comparison. Absolutely.
I think that each and every one of us is also capable of. So there is a thing within your brain which has been referred to as the empathy circuit. It takes 10 of the regions of your brain, and you could, if one of them kind of shuts down for whatever reason, you can lose your empathy. And one example where the parts of the brain doesn't work properly in this empathy circuit is within those that have psychopathy. So the psychopaths, the parts of their brain for empathy don't work properly. But what's kind of even more interesting is if we look back and let's take the crimes of the Nazis in World War II and the way that what was happening, we see that there's two things that we see kind of often. The idea of, oh, I just make the trains run on time. Each person being isolated within their own piece of the puzzle in order to create this grander evil. But
yep.
Even those people, and that, like, they still have to turn their empathy off. I would bet you, without a doubt in my mind, that many of the people that were Nazis were in fact just regular people that then ended up having these parts of their brain shut down because of what's happening around them, and that they're indoctrinated into a thing. They're made to think of other people without empathy. They're made to do this. And what that tells us is that it's not just that there is evil, which would be psychopathy, for example, but also that evil can be created.
Yes. Yes, you can make how many. I won't say this correctly, but I believe there are systems in place in most world governments that turn Joe Blow from Kokomo, the nice kid from the farm, or the nice kid from the suburbs, or the guy that plays b-ball in the inner city, into the most horrific killer that ever existed on the face of the earth. There's no doubt about that in my mind either. And we've been doing that for millennia.
Well, if you want an example of that, look at I'm going to get this completely wrong. One of the government agencies there, FBI or CIA, whatever one, I don't remember. You definitely do your own research, listeners. But one of the things that I remember coming out about that was how they were – it stopped several terrorist attacks. But if you looked into it, the other thing that they were doing, though, was essentially creating terrorists in order to then stop them. They were targeting people and then walking them through a system of indoctrination, thinking that they were being indoctrinated by somebody else, and catching them when they're about to do a thing. Well, this is just creating that idea of what they did was they took someone who, as far as we know, and that if they never encountered any of this, then they probably would have just went off and did their own life. But instead, they were walked through a series of hoops and balances in order to just reduce the empathy that they had to those around them enough that they could do something horrific.
Yeah.
And the point of this was what? I imagine you could argue, oh, well, then that's how you find out who's a potential terrorist. But that person wasn't a potential terrorist. They made them into one.
Yeah, they made them. Well, look at Ted Bundy. I mean, he was, in a sense, Ted Bundy was, not Ted Bundy, the Unabomber. The Unabomber, right?
Yeah.
In many senses, he was a terrorist. So I think he only killed a couple people in his bombs, but it wasn't for the lack of trying, right? When he was in college, I forget which college he was in, but he volunteered for several experiments. And when you read all those experiments, I recommend everybody please go and Google the Unabomber and see the experiments he participated in, drove him insane. And that was never brought up.
I actually don't know much about him myself.
The Unabomber? He's the guy that hated technology, so he started sending mail bombs to people.
About the mail bombs, but what you actually made me think of, do you remember, I believe it was Charles Whitman? Was he the sniper at the University of Texas?
Yeah, he had a brain tumor, yeah.
A brain tumor, yeah, exactly, and that, which, like, his note that he left was essentially, like, I don't feel like myself, I don't feel normal, look into what happened to me.
Yeah,
and you find he has a brain tumor, and there was a book I was reading where one person was arrested on charges of pedophilia, I think it was child porn, it might have been an attempt at molestation, whatever it was, he goes to jail. In jail, he ends up collapsing, and they find out he has a brain tumor, and they cut that out of him, and all of those urges leave. Then,
right.
A few years later, he starts to be acting like that again. He goes into the hospital. There's a new tumor that they remove. And so, it's really weird to think that what's all that's stopping us as you, Wayne, me, Zach, from being the most evil person in existence is either somebody whispering in our ear or a medical emergency.
Yeah. I mean, I look at my past when I was an alcoholic, an active alcoholic. I was absolute asshole alcoholic. By the time I was 30, I was absolutely a fucking worthless human being because of my alcoholism, right? I did all kinds of very mean things to a few people to make sure I got enough things to drink, right? Thankfully,
that was me
able,
with drugs. I feel bad.
Yep. And thankfully, through some Sherlock, the invention of people and God's love, I was able to quit drinking, right? And have now, I'm going to call a much better life. And I don't miss it. I'm very happy. I did not do anything worse, right? Because I easily could have. So I look at not so much the Barcelona woman, right, who I think was more or less more of a setup job, but some of these other people that I wrote about in Dark Minds and Bloody Hands, and the person that you talked about and other things we talk about in this show, it so easily could have been me. Too easily.
Yeah, that is it's a scary thought, isn't it, my friend?
Yeah. So you read the book Dark Minds and Bloody Hands, which is available on Amazon with all my other books by simply going to Amazon and Googling my name. All my books will be there. Please check them out. All money is gathered by those books. Help me take care of the cats here at my home. And where can we find you online, Zach?
Well, I got several places. The one that I'm most active at is my Twitter, which is Zach Long, or you can find it at Light is Fading. I also run a website that's dedicated to helping genre screenwriters. That's called scriptophobic.ca. scriptophobic.ca. I also run writeindarkness.com. And if you go to Write in Darkness, you'll find links to all my writing and everything and every podcast I've been on. But I'm also on Amazon. My book, Screenwriting, A Comprehensive Guide to Writing the Horror Screenplay, is available in paperback and ebook. And if you're interested in the way that evil works, that gets really deep into how we deal with fear and what horror even is, as not just a genre, but as an emotion, and how it ties to our biological evolution.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to have to get that book for that alone, because the one thing that fascinates me is I like a good horror movie. I like a good horror movie with what's the noise under the bed, what's the thing in the closet, what's in the basement, right? Not so much, let's take 30,000 gallons of fake blood and throw it on a screen, right? I know from a teenager that if I found a woman girlfriend, right, who liked horror films, I took her to one, I had a much better chance of being lucky afterwards than not so much. And I'd like to find out why that happened. I'm fascinated by that thought.
Oh, I can tell you that one right now.
Please.
When you watch a horror movie that scares you, and that your body releases endorphins, and that your heart rate increases, and that you think your brain ties that not just to the film you're watching, but also to your experience of when you like somebody, your heart increases around them, your brain shoots off endorphins. So you can make the connection from the movie you're watching. You actually connect more to the person next to you because your brain thinks, like, it's not just this movie, it's this movie and this person.
Person. Oh, really? Interesting. God, fascinating conversation of that alone. But again, sir, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, and thank you for all the help you've been in my writings and stuff over the years. I look forward to working with you in different projects as they may come our way, sir.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime, Wayne. I'm always happy to help or chat.
All right, sir. Thanks again. You have a fantastically cool day. All right. This has been my first show of Radio Free Mafia. You can find all my books at, of course, if you Google my name, I go to Amazon and type in my name, Wayne Klingman. You'll find them, Klingman with a C, Klingman. I recommend highly for after today's episode that you look at Dark Minds and Bloody Hands. I think it's a Kindle for $2.99. All my other books will be there as well. We have a lot of shows coming up this week. Tomorrow we have a show. We're going to be talking charity poker games. Fascinating subject, because I'm a big call. I like to be a big poker player, but I'm not. I'm absolutely fascinated with the idea of using poker as a way to raise funds for charity and how that system works and how much money you can have doing so. Anyway, talk to you all then. Have a great day, and have fun. Bye-bye.